Okay. So last week we were studying and looking at the sale of Joseph up into Egypt, how Joseph's brothers wanted to kill him, but then they didn't kill him. They threw him in a ditch. And then some traders came riding by, and it was decided, well, let's not kill him. Let's sell him to these traders. And the traders sold him to Potiphar, who was captain of the guard, a man of influence. And, of course, the brothers deceived Jacob by taking his tunic and putting some goat's blood on it. A loving family. So we come to chapter 38. Chapter 38. A bizarre event seems at first glance to intrude on the story of Joseph. However, it served an important purpose in Genesis. It confirmed God's plan of selecting the younger over the elder, despite how others attempted to contravene it. Now, I want to show you something. I think this will be a good idea for me to show this to you now. And then when we read, it'll be easier to follow what's going on. Sometimes I talk about the brilliance and the genius of God. And of course, that even that, you know, is critical of God, because he's not a genius. He's in a whole different realm. But here's the problem. Let's say this is Egypt. Okay, so here's Egypt. And then let's say over here was where Jacob and his family dwelled. Now, you know, it says in the Bible, my ways are not your ways and my thoughts are not your thoughts. And sometimes we look at what's happening and saying, where is God in the midst of this? So we see poor Joseph did nothing wrong. And we see his brothers hate him. And it's a hatred born of jealousy. I think we can see that. They're afraid he was going to be treated as the firstborn, whereas Reuben was really the firstborn, get most of the inheritance and so forth and so on. So they see him coming when they're tending the sheep, and they said, let's kill him, and we don't have to worry about him anymore. And Jacob goes through a series of circumstances which, for all intents and purposes, seem like tragedies in his life. However, God is behind the scenes, sovereignly watching over and controlling events and using people who are making their own decisions, but God in his genius is touching their hearts and overseeing all that happens to Joseph during this time. Now, we know, or we will know when we haven't done the chapter yet, but what we're going to find out is there's going to be 7 years of abundance. I'll just put good. 7 good years are going to come. This is Joseph interpreting a dream for Pharaoh. And we'll read all this, but this, if you get the big picture, I think it's a good idea. But then that's going to be followed by 7 years of famine. Now the problem here is, how are Jacob and his family going to survive the famine? How is Egypt going to survive the famine? I mean, when they talked about famines in biblical times, it's not like, oh, I went to the grocery store today, and do you know what tomatoes are a pound? That's not a famine. It's when there's no tomatoes, period. So God's intention, here's what he intended to do. He intended, and we'll see why, to get Joseph close to Pharaoh. That was God's objective. He had a goal in mind. And the reason he wanted Joseph to be close to him was because through a relationship that God would develop between Joseph and Pharaoh, this famine, it couldn't be avoided. It was going to be a famine. But Joseph, God gave him the wisdom to see how he could survive the famine. So when we look at the events that take place, first we see, you know, the brothers are doing things to Joseph that are very cruel. But it says in the Bible, all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And the good, of course, is taking on the character of the Messiah and doing his will. So they throw him in a pit. At first, they wanted to kill him, but Reuben convinced them not to kill him. Let's just throw him in the pit. And then they sold him to some Midianite traders. And the Midianite traders took him to Egypt and sold him to Potiphar. And Potiphar held a very high position in Egypt. He was captain of the guard. That's a high position. And Joseph, God gave Joseph so much wisdom that Potiphar didn't even look over the affairs of his own household. He trusted Joseph to do it because Joseph proved himself to be trustworthy and wise. But now, Potiphar's wife enters the scene. And I'm going to have to read it again, but one thing I think I did notice when I read it, whenever something happens in the Bible, God always gives the names of people who are involved. I don't think her name is even mentioned in the Bible. God didn't even want to give her that because she was a very wicked woman. And what she does is she's married to Potiphar, but she tries and tries and tries to seduce Joseph. And it gets to the point, and we'll see this when we read the scripture, not only would Joseph not do this, it got to the point he wouldn't even be around her. He didn't even want to be in the same room as her. Yes?
I just noticed today for the first time, it says Potiphar was a eunuch.
Excuse me?
It says Potiphar was a eunuch. So it's interesting that a eunuch would have a wife. And
now, where did you get that information from? Well, I just wanted to see where it is in the Bible.
Yeah, but okay. Here we go. Chapter 39, verse 1. A eunuch of Pharaoh, chief of the executioner.
Wait, let me turn to it. I want to see this. 39:1. I don't see that there. It just says, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. I don't see anything about Potiphar being a eunuch. That's why I asked you your source, because if your source is not the Bible, I can't. But it's not. Well, it's not in 31:1. What was your other passage?
The other one just says the chief of the executioners. That's 38. 36.
38:36. Let's see what that says. Yeah, it only goes to 38:30. Yeah, I don't believe Potiphar was a eunuch, and I don't think the scriptures state that.
Well, look, the Hebrew, the Bible here claims that the Hebrew has it.
Yeah, but I don't see where the Hebrew would have it. There's no words there, and there's no implication that he would be a eunuch. There's no, when we read those verses, there's no, sometimes when you read the Bible in English, they let you know that this particular word means such and such, but all of the words in these verses are pretty clear and apparently easily translatable. Or in a concordance. But I don't see it and didn't see it anywhere during my studies. If you find it, let us know. But anyway, coming back to this, Potiphar wants Joseph to get close to Pharaoh. And you know, towards the end, when the brothers are scared, when they're with Joseph and they're afraid as soon as Jacob dies, then Joseph's going to come on. And Joseph said to his brothers, "What you meant for evil, God meant for good." That's a key verse. So what we have here, Joseph's in Potiphar's house, and Joseph's wife tries and tries and tries to seduce him. He won't do it, and he says to her, "How, you know, your husband's been good to me. How can I do this and sin against God?" So finally, one day, she makes advances towards him, and he just runs away. But he leaves his cloak there when he runs away. So Potiphar's evil wife starts yelling and screaming, and they come in and says, and she says, "Joseph tried to rape me, and here's his cloak. He just ran away." So now Joseph goes to prison for that. And actually, he could have been hanged for it. Potiphar could have just said, "Hang him." It's possible that there's two possible reasons that he wasn't hung. I mean, in the normal course of events, you commit adultery with the wife of the captain of the guard, you're gone. But the two reasons I believe that we could speculate that Joseph was not hung was, number one, up to that point, Joseph had been a tremendous blessing to Potiphar, and he probably weighed that on the scale. The other possibility is maybe Potiphar didn't have complete confidence in his wife's integrity because he knew her, he was married to her. And maybe he said, "Well, here we go again." We don't know. But at any rate, Joseph's in prison. But God, again, providentially, works through the life of Joseph and prospers him so much that the jailer makes him like Joseph. It's like Joseph becomes the warden. And the actual warden, the jailer, just lets Joseph run the jail. Now, while Joseph is in prison, he meets two people, a baker, used to be the baker for, give me a minute and we'll get to it. A baker, and we'll get to that in a minute, and the cupbearer for Potiphar. Now, just as a little bit of an aside, the cupbearer, of course, would bring wine to Pharaoh, but this position, cupbearer, was an extremely high position in Egypt, and here's why. First of all, the cupbearer had to make sure that no one was attempting to poison Pharaoh with food or drink. That was very important. He had to oversee the kitchen, the deliveries of food, everything. Also, the cupbearer was like the eyes and ears of Pharaoh in Egypt. He would mill around and, you know, go into bars or whatever they had, and listen and be able to come back and let Pharaoh know what's going on. It's a very high position, and he also gave advice to Pharaoh. But Pharaoh became very angry with these two men, and in the Hebrew, it's really he became enraged, and he put them in jail. So one morning, Joseph goes and he sees the cupbearer and the baker sitting there, and he can tell that they're very upset and sad. And Joseph says to them, "What's wrong?" And they both said, "We had dreams last night that really greatly disturbed us." Now, they didn't know what those dreams meant, but Joseph, being a prophet, could interpret dreams. And the interpretation of a dream in Egypt at this time was very meaningful, because the Egyptians did believe that dreams could foretell the true, the picture, if you, the future, if you interpret them correctly. So the cupbearer says, let me get exactly what he says, because the wording is important. And the cupbearer says, get back up, get. Okay, now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. So I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Then Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches, see, he saw a vine with three branches. I should have backed up a couple of verses. Are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. So that was a good dream, good news. And then Joseph adds on to that, since this is going to happen to you, he says, only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house, because I was kidnapped and I didn't do anything wrong," and so forth and so on. Then the chief baker, who had a similar dream, says this, and the chief baker is happy now because he thinks, sees things are going well. And he says, it says, when the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, he said to Joseph, I also saw in my dream, and behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. And in the top basket, there were some of all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, and the birds were eating them out of the basket in my head. And Joseph interpreted, the three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off you. So you can see that although the three dreams are similar, there's slight differences in them. Both have this number three that's important. But the cupbearer, when you look at what's going to happen to him in 3 days, it was a blessing. He'd be out of prison, back in his former condition, once again serving wine to Pharaoh and all the things that went with the cupbearer. And the baker, in 3 days, was going to be hanged on a tree. Now, if you look at it, the cupbearer had a vine with wonderful grapes on it, and he was able to make the wine and give it to Pharaoh. But the three baskets on the baker's head, all the bread was for Pharaoh. All the bread was, the birds were eating all the bread, and that wasn't a good sign. And it was a sign that he wasn't going to be returned to his former position. He was going to be hung. So 3 days passed, and sure enough, Pharaoh called for the cupbearer and the baker. And just as Joseph had said, the cupbearer was restored to his former position. The interpretation of the dream was correct. The baker was hanged, just as the interpretation said. So both of these are out of prison now. The baker's dead, and the cupbearer's back in his old position. That's all about Joseph. But then Pharaoh had some dreams. We're not going to get into them right now, but nobody in Egypt could interpret them. And then the cupbearer remembered, oh, in the prison there was a man who interpreted my dreams very accurately. And Pharaoh calls for him. Notice, remember when I said God wants to get Joseph close to Pharaoh? See where this is going? And Joseph listens to Pharaoh and listens to his dreams, and he interprets the dreams correctly and advises Pharaoh what to do. And his advice was extremely wise. So now he's close to Pharaoh, and in the same way he ran the prison, it wasn't long before he was running Egypt. He was second only to Pharaoh in the throne. And so now God has accomplished what he wanted to do, and that is get Joseph close to Pharaoh. And Joseph was now in a position whereby, because of his, he ran Egypt for Pharaoh. And so Joseph, through a series of events, had his family. Oh, one of the things he told Pharaoh to do is, over the next 7 years of abundance, take 1/5 of the yield of the land and store it. And you can do that with grain. You know, some things you can't be with grain. And make sure it's watched over. And then during the 7 years of famine, you'll have all that grain to see you through the famine. That's the advice he gave him. And then Joseph had his family come up into Egypt. And Pharaoh rejoiced with it. This was a good Pharaoh. He liked Joseph. So Joseph's family came up to Egypt and settled in a land in the Egyptian borders called Goshen. And they were kept alive throughout the famine. So the point is, we can see now how God was working in Joseph's life, and what appeared to be tragic incidents were actually God working sovereignly behind the scenes to accomplish his good will. I mean, how in the world, suppose I said to myself, I have some great ideas. I'd like to sit down for a couple of hours with the president and talk to him. There's no way that would happen. In a million years, that wouldn't happen. But it happened here because of this series of events. Okay? So I just wanted to go over that with you because that's the big picture there. And now when we read the chapter, all will be clear. That's right. Drop the thing. Okay. So now we're back on page 38. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. Both the references that I have that say unit, they use the same word, and it's...
What are the... Just tell me the references.
56, well, okay. 37, 36.
Wait, 37, 36.
And
wait, let me read it.
37,
36. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. Where do you get he was a eunuch from that?
It says sold him to Potiphar, a eunuch
That's too much of it. I have a problem with that.
But let me tell you, they have a Strong's number on unit.
Yeah, but it's too, I would have to look into that and tell you why. I could keep an open mind, but a translation like the New American Standard, although different translations vary, that's a, if in fact that verse had a Hebrew expression that indicated that Potiphar were a eunuch, that would be a major flaw in this Bible that I don't think exists.
We have Tanakhs in the library.
I have an exhaustive concordance, and I can check it.
I'm asking you about, in that library, can I pick up a...
You can pick up whatever you want as long as you put it back. Yeah, but do you understand what I'm saying? That's too far afield.
I understand, but when they put Strong's number on it, and they use the same word in the chapter 39, where I would want to know why they're leaving it out of...
Chapter 39 in what verse?
1, I believe.
1, 39:1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. It's too far afield for me to see a eunuch. And even there, this would be such a glaring, tremendous error on the part of the translators that I have to see it. I'd have to look in the Hebrew myself and see where you can fit that in there anywhere. It's more than an error. It's nonsense.
They do it twice with the same...
Okay, I understand what you're saying. All I'm saying is I read the New American Standard exclusively because of how literal it is. So... I can't see it unless I'm shown something. It can't even fit in there anywhere.
You mean there's no spaces for the letters? I'm
talking about the translation. It was a eunuch, and it says that...
Each time they say they sold him to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, and while the English is saying an officer of Pharaoh, the Hebrew is saying a eunuch of Pharaoh.
That's too far afield. For me, that's too far afield.
I didn't know.
I'm just giving you my response. It just goes too far afield from what the scriptures are saying. Okay, let's continue. Okay, Genesis chapter 39. Wait, it's almost half of the thing already. Ready? Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Wait, I got to turn back. I'm on the wrong page here, of course. Okay. The Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how God caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. It came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So here we have Joseph, a servant in Potiphar's house, and Potiphar can see quite clearly that he is being tremendously blessed by having this servant in his house. And so Joseph found favor in the eyes of Potiphar. Okay, going to the notes. Do we do chapter 38? why am I, wait, then what's going on around here? I might have read the wrong thing just then. Yeah, I'm reading from the wrong chapter. I should have checked the notes more closely. Okay. Okay, so we have, let me read again, and then I'll read from verses 1 to 5. Let's do 1 to 5 in the notes. Judah, who had suggested that the brothers sell Joseph to the Ishmaelites, then left and stayed with Adullam and married a Canaanite woman, which he was not supposed to do. They had three sons, Onan, and Shelah. This marriage to a Canaanite woman almost ruined Judah's family. Intermarriage with the Canaanites had been avoided, but not here. So at the least, we can say Judah was not acting wisely. And remember, Judah is in the line of the seed, the line of blessing. So what Judah is essentially doing is now mixing the line of blessing with a line of idolatry, the Canaanites. This account of assimilation with the people of the land helps one understand why God settled his young nation. It should be in the safety of Egypt for its growth. When the Jewish people were in Egypt, were not belittling how much they suffered. But God knows the end of all things, and he knew that although they were in slavery, he did watch over them and protect them for 400 hard years, but he kept them safe, not only from attack from one of these bands of bandits that rode around, but from themselves, so that things like this wouldn't happen. When they were living in Goshen, they weren't exposed to the Canaanites. Now that they're out of Egypt, now they have like 3 million of them. And so Judah decided to marry a Canaanite woman, which was, it disrupted the line of the seed. Because now what you're going to have, if God doesn't do something, is you're going to have a descendant of Judah sitting on the king who is really not pure Judahite. He's part Judah and he's part Canaanite. And that's not the idea here. Okay. Verses 6 to 11. Now Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's life and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. And this was a very common custom in those days, whereby it's something similar to what happened in the book of Ruth. Remember, Ruth was a widow, and so since her husband had died and now they're back with the Jewish people, it was the responsibility of a man in Ruth's family to raise up children through Ruth. He wasn't too thrilled about it. And Boaz wisely in front of the elders purchased from this other relative who had first dibs on her that he would take her for his wife. It's a beautiful love story. But the point is, this was not unusual, and God had it done to keep the line of the man moving, that it wouldn't come to an end. That was like a curse. Okay? So, to our... Okay, so then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your family. That's what he was supposed to do. Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So when he went in to his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. Later in the Mosaic law, that's going to be forbidden. But you see what he did. He did have sexual relations with her, but he did so in a way that she wouldn't conceive. He didn't act. It's called the withdrawal method today. Very poor. If you're going to have any kind of birth control, it's the worst you can have. Onanism?
Onanism.
Okay, so. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord. So he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar. Now there's one more child left, right? Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son, Shelah, grows up. For he thought, I am afraid that he too may die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. And you see what happened here. Tamar's first husband had died. Tamar's husband died. And so attempted to raise up seed for his brother. He died. And then Onan, it was his responsibility to raise up seed. He didn't want to do it. So he spilled the seed on the ground. God took his life. And at this point, Judah said, everybody who comes near this woman dies. So he said to himself, he said to Tamar, just remain a widow in your father's house. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. Judah went up, and when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. So now Judah is a widower now. He doesn't have a wife anymore. It was told to Tamar, and you can imagine Tamar wasn't happy with these circumstances. Mourning, you know, she went into mourning for husband after husband, and then her adoptive father, in a sense, said to her, that's it. No more touching you. Go live in your father's house as a widow. And she probably wasn't very pleased with that. So she, now Tamar is told that his father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Anaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. In other words, Shelah at first was a child, not old enough to impregnate a woman. But now he grows up, and grow up doesn't mean he's 40 or 50 now. It means now he's maybe in his late teens, and he's able to impregnate a woman now. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. You know, when you were walking along the roadside, it was very easy to identify harlots because of how they dressed. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, here now, let me come into you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me that you may come into me. He said, therefore, I will send you a young goat from the flock. She said, moreover, will you give me a pledge until you send it? He said, what pledge shall I give you? And she said, your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments again. So here Judah was tricked. He was tricked by her. She goes back to her father's house, puts on her widow's clothes again, and he's none the wiser. Okay, back in the notes, let me just see something. We should read a little bit more scripture. That's not a good stopping point. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. Now remember what Judah had given her. He gave her his seal. They would wear their seal and a cord around their neck. And a seal was very important. Like when you entered into an agreement with someone, if you want to document it on paper, you put your seal on it. The seal was very important. And also the staff. The staff was usually very ornate and valuable and could be identified as your staff. So she had, Judah was really acting very foolishly to give these things to her, but this is what he did. So when Yeshua sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the man of her place, saying, where is the temple prostitute who was by the road in Anaim? But they said, there has been no temple prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep them. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. If we go and start to find her and do a search and can't find her anywhere and start asking people and they find out why I want to see her, I'll become a laughingstock. Let it go. After all, I sent this young goat, but you didn't find her. I kept my part of the bargain. She didn't keep hers. But I don't want to become a laughingstock in the community that I gave my seal and my staff to her, and now she's gone. Okay. Now, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. In other words, when Judah apparently began to show, she was accused of being a harlot, of being a prostitute, and the news got back to Judah. And of course, still, Judah had no idea that this would be his child. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. It was while she was being brought out that she said to her father-in-law, saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I. See, now Judah understood what happened there. He understood what Tamar did and why she did it, because he didn't do right. And so, although Tamar did something that was risky and not the most moral thing she could do, even in those circumstances, Judah said, she's still more righteous than I was, because I'm the seed that caused all this stuff. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give to her my son Shelah. If he had done that, none of this would have ever happened. and he did not have relations with her again. Because now he knew that she was his daughter-in-law, and it's not proper to have relations with your daughter-in-law. It came about at the time she was giving born, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. And the purpose of the scarlet thread, of course, is so they could tell the one from the other, because the twins, they were identical twins. And has anybody ever here have had any friends who were identical twins? I had some close friends who were identical twins. And at first, I could not tell them apart. They were mirror images of one another. After about a month or so, I could. You could tell. There are differences, but at first, they can look. You can't tell one from the other. You know what these twins used to do in school? Go to class for one another. You know, one of the twins would say, I don't feel like going to school today. Go to my classes. And he would go to his class. It was really weird. Okay, so. Moreover, but it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez, which means a breach. Afterward, her brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. Okay? And Zerah means, it translates, a dawning or brightness. Okay, so let's see what happens here. Let's go to the notes. And we're right now on page 142, the wickedness of Judah's sons. Let's see how we're doing here. But we'll take our break now. Okay, we're on page 142 in your notes. And we're right in the middle where it says the wickedness of Judah's sons. Judah's first son, Er, died because he was wicked. His second son, Onan, was to marry Tamar, the widow of his brother, to raise up offspring for his brother under the custom of the Levirate law of marriage, from the Latin lever, husband's brother. However, Onan used the law for sexual gratification. He took advantage of this situation, but refused to accept the responsibility that went with it. So God took his life. In view of this situation, Judah refused to give his third son, Shelah, to Tamar, Er's widow. Shelah was not yet grown, but later, when he was an adult, Judah still refused. So, thus, the family's future was placed in jeopardy. You know, and this is a family that has to continue on. It's the line of the seed. Tamar thought that she had to take matters into her own hands if she was to be granted the rights of the Levirate custom. In other words, she would be an heir. She would be a member of the family. This system was later codified by Moses for the sake of preserving the name for the deceased. You know, sometimes in a family, the last name, it disappears. Because people don't have children, they have only female children to get married. And especially in those days, they wanted the line to carry on. When the time seemed right, Tamar deceptively lured her father-in-law Judah into an immoral union with a temple prostitute, or so he thought. What's it's just nonsense. Pledge. So he thought. In pledge that he would send a goat for payment, he left his seal, which was suspended from a cord around his neck, and his staff with her. I mean, what he was doing was wrong, but it was also stupid. Really? I mean, if you went to buy a car, and there was somebody was selling their car, and you checked it out, and you knew this was the car for you, right? And the person said, well, I'll sell you the car for $12,000. And you said, okay, I'll go get the $12,000, I'll give you cash, and you'll sign the title over to me. And then the person says to you, that's fine, but if I'm going to take the car off the market, I need a pledge. Give me $1,000 now and go get the rest. Who in the world would do that? Who would just hand somebody $1,000 and leave? And that's pretty much what he did. Judah lacked integrity, and now he was seen to be a hypocrite. You know, he wouldn't let anybody have sexual relationships with Tamar. In the meantime, he wound up having them with her and bearing a child. When Tamar was reported as being 3 months pregnant, he condemned her to death as a prostitute. Then she produced the seal, cord, and staff that he was the guilty partner. Tamar had won the right to be the mother of Judah's children, though in a deceitful way. Her action was desperate and wicked. Risky. It was a desperate move on her part. She wanted children, and here she is a widow, and she was desperate. But it was risky. You never know what Judah might have been in a mood and said, kill them both. You know, you never know what's going to happen in a situation like this. Okay, the elder shall serve the younger. The final part of the story provides the significance of the whole account. God gave Tamar twins, and the line of Judah continued because of her. But in the birth of the boys, an unusual event occurred, paralleling the births of Jacob and Esau. After one twin's hand came out, the other made a breach and was born first, so he was rightly named Perez, which means breach. The second twin was named Zerah, which means scarlet, because of the scarlet thread the midwife tied on his wrist. It was as if the oracle concerning Jacob ruling over his brother was being relived in the line of Judah. Of course, the younger were obviously going to serve the elder because the elder had died. It appears that way. He and his brothers sold Joseph into slavery in Egypt, thinking they could thwart God's design that the elder brothers would serve the younger Joseph. And of course, their whole plan was falling apart now. Yet in Judah's own family, despite Judah's efforts to hinder Tamar's marriage, God's will was worked out in a dramatic confirmation of the principle that the elder would serve the younger. The line of promise would carry on through Perez, for God's program cannot so easily be set aside. Who?
Tamar. Is she Jewish?
I can't hear the name.
Tamar.
No, she was a Canaanite.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, she was a Canaanite, which was the first step leading towards destruction. Yes?
We could say it's the second step because Judah himself married a Canaanite woman.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. All right, let's see where we are now. Oh, this is short. Let me see, chapter 39. Well, it's a little too long for that. I'm trying to decide. I don't know if I want to start chapter 39 right now, because although the notes covering it aren't all that long, the chapter is long. And it involves some things that I don't want to just skim over. Joseph's imprisonment is here, and his success in Egypt and so forth. And we only have just a couple minutes left, so let's just leave it here for now. And we'll pick it up next Thursday.